ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ हि पार्थव्यपाश्रित्य येऽपि स्युपापयो नयः स्त्रियो वैश्यस्तथा शूद्रास्तेऽपि यान्ति परां गतिम्। Service, there is no distinction between the lower and higher classes of people. In the material conception of life, there are such divisions, but for a person engaged in transcendental devotional service to the Lord, there are not. Everyone is eligible for the supreme destination. In the Srimad Bhagavatam 2.4.18, it is stated that even the lowest, who are called chandalas, dog-eaters, can be purified by association with a pure devotee. Therefore, devotional service and the guidance of a pure devotee are so strong that there is no discrimination between the lower and higher classes of men. Anyone can take to it. The most simple man taking shelter of the pure devotee can be purified by proper guidance. According to the different modes of material nature, men are classified in the mode of goodness, brahmanas, the mode of passion, kshatriyas, or administrators, the mixed modes of passion and ignorance, vaishyas, or merchants, and the mode of ignorance, shudras, or workers. Those lower than them are called chandalas, and they are born in sinful families. Generally, the association of those born in sinful families is not accepted by the higher classes. But the process of devotional service is so strong that the pure devotee of the Supreme Lord can enable people of all the lower classes to attain the highest perfection of life. This is possible only when one takes shelter of Krishna. As indicated here by the word vyapashritya, one has to take shelter completely of Krishna. Then one can become much greater than great jnanis and yogis. We'll read the translation one more time. O son of Prita, those who take shelter in me, though they be of lower birth, women, vaishyas, merchants, and shudras, workers, can attain the supreme destination. So welcome to everyone for coming to tonight's program. Lest the accusation be there that the Lord has no sense of humor, I find it very interesting how he scheduled me to speak the verse on women in Bhagavad Gita on the night of the Chaitanya festival. Incidentally, he's also discussing shudras and chandalas in this verse, so I think I've been hand-picked for the task at hand tonight. So this is a very key verse in the Bhagavad Gita because by itself, single-handedly, it defeats this misconceived notion that the caste system is some oppressive system meant for exploiting the lower castes in India. It's a system meant for some people to exercise undue control over others. This is the common perception of the caste system in India, but also in other parts of the world, and was very instrumental in people in India for rejecting their own tradition, and also for Westerners or people from another tradition to denigrate the Vedic scriptures or the Vedic social system on the basis of the caste system. They said, this system is so backwards, therefore we can reject everything from these scriptures. So this is the very modern perception of the mention of these varnas here in this verse, of the vaishyas, of the shudras, and also Lord Krishna is also grouping together women in the same category as the shudras and the vaishyas. So what we'll try to do today is to elaborate on Srila Prabhupada's points to explain how varnashram system is actually eternal and always existing, but simultaneously, it's irrelevant in terms of one's Sanatan Dharma or duties in terms of devotional service. Prabhupada is saying that there is no distinction between the lower and higher classes of people. So therefore, we're going to try to balance these comments that Prabhupada is making about these lower orders, such as women, Vaishyas, and Shudras, with transcendental knowledge, as given here in this verse. So we'll begin by just examining, is it fair for the scriptures to say that we can divide up all of people into these four orders? Is there really such a thing as Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras? Is it fair? Or is it just a tool that some of these so-called people in higher castes use to exploit others? I would argue that no matter where you go, no matter which part of the world, no matter which time you go, you will always find society divided into certain social divisions. No matter which political system is being practiced, who's in power, there are always going to be distinctions between the occupational duties of individuals in society. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Chaturvarnyam maya srishtam gunakarma vibhagashah tasyakartaram apimam vidyakartaram avyayam. That along with the creation of this universe, I, Krishna, also created these four social divisions. They are an eternal aspect of the material world and are completely inextricable from human society. That being said, what's the evidence? Well, there's a short story given in the Indian tradition of a pastime that took place between Akbar and Birbal, whom you may be knowing. In this famous story, one day in the court, some of the Shudras, as part of Akbar's entourage, they developed enmity and much envy towards his chief advisor, whose name was Birbal. They said, this Birbal, all he does all day is just sit down on this seat next to the king. He speaks a few words, hears a few cases, deliberates on some philosophy, but he's lazy. All he's doing is so useless, whereas we're the guards, we're defending the king. If someone came to attack, we could save his life. We're the one doing all the heavy duties and responsibilities. So therefore, why is he getting so much remuneration and respect and honor? Why don't we deserve more credit? And so they took this plea to the king. They entreated him that, why is there such inequality in the way you treat your Birbal and the way you treat us? And the king thought about this and he said, to answer your question, I posit a challenge. A challenge is open to everyone, including my Birbal, and it goes as follows. He said, I want someone to bring the royal elephant immediately. And so the royal elephant was brought from the stables, a massive beast was brought into the court, and he asked, can anybody in this room tell me what is the weight of this elephant in kilograms, in tonnage? You can't just guess blindly, I want it down to the milligram. What is the weight of our royal elephant? I give you 24 hours to come to a solution. Anybody who can come up with this value will supersede my Birbal, take his position. And so the guards at the king's court, they started conspiring, how can we actually weigh this elephant? And so they contrived all sorts of means. They went and found the regular scale to weigh humans, but alas, it was too small. The elephant would crush it in an instant. So they tried thinking, well, maybe we could build a big scale. We could go to the market and see where they weigh the grains. And they just were racking their brains all day and all night, but they couldn't come to a solution. The problem of weighing the elephant was beyond their grasp. And they decided that this task is impossible. So they returned dejected to Akbar's court the next day. And so he said, so, what is your answer? How much does the royal elephant weigh? And all the guards responded, it's an impossible task, nobody can say. And so Akbar, he very slyly looked at his advisor Birbal and he said, Birbal, is this true? Is it a fact? We can't weigh the royal elephant? And Birbal announced, No, my lord, he weighs exactly 1,243 kilos. And everybody was astonished. How on earth did you come up with this figure? He must have made it up. And so the king was also curious. He inquired, well, how did you come to this? And Birbal replied, well, it was very simple, my lord. I went down to the river where there's the big boat, the big merchant ship, which carries all the cargo back and forth. And what I did was I measured the water line with a marker, and I charted on the boat on the exterior where does the water line come to. Afterwards, I took the elephant, placed them on the boat, and then I took the new water mark to see how much the boat had sunk and where the new water line was. We took the elephant off the boat, and then we started placing official standard weights on the boat. And when the boat was sufficiently weighed down that it met the watermark, we stopped adding weight, and that's how I derived the figure, like that. And everybody in the court was aghast. Wow, what genius! What an amazing intellect this Birbal has! And they all started cheering, Birbal ki jai! And the king looked at the guards and he says, so now you understand why you're over there and why he's here? And the guards hung their heads in shame and vowed to never again question the position of this royal advisor. So we find that this is the innate advantage or superiority of one who is situated in the Brahminical modes of goodness, is that they have access to their intelligence to a far greater capacity than other people in society. So one may question, well, with this example, you can weigh an elephant. What's the big deal? What's the practical usage of this? But we find it's these individuals throughout history who are fixed in goodness who can actually perform these tasks intellectually, who are the ones who have swayed history to the greatest extent. Like, for example, during World War II, what was the greatest factor which dictated the victor in the war? And you could very much make a case that it was due to the great scientific knowledge of Albert Einstein and Robert Oppenheimer, that they had actually come up with this knowledge of the atom. They had cracked the secrets of nuclear fission, fusion, of hydrogen bomb and nuclear bomb. And it was because of them, even though the Axis countries may have been so rich in weaponry or manpower or infantry or soldiers or resources, still, it did not hold up to the power or the advantage of just one highly gifted intellectual in the empire. Jai Shri Siddhartha Gopinath Bhagwan ki jai. So therefore we see that these divisions are very real. But before we start to before we take the next step, let's examine what is the role of the Shudra then. So Shudra we tend to take in a very negative, pejorative sense, that the Shudra deserves no respect, he's abused, he's not allowed privilege or access to certain places or positions. But actually, in the Vedic culture, the Shudra was highly respected and played a most crucial role in the society and was actually a very exclusive position, because a Shudra is still a part of the Varnashram system. These four Varnas are considered as being part of progressive human life, that if one actually considers oneself human, then one falls within one of these four categories. What Prabhupada is intimating in this purport is that there are these four varnas, and then even the lowest, who are called chandalas, dog eaters, they can also be purified, Prabhupada is saying. So he's saying, beyond your varnashram orders, there's also those who are outside of varnashram. These are your chandalas, these are your mlechas, your yavanas, those who are not following Varnashram, and those who are following Varnashram. So what does it take to actually be considered a good Shudra? It's said in the 16th chapter of Gita, Tejakshama Driti Shaucham Adroho Nati Manitam, that the Kshatriya, he has to be very bold, daring, courageous, he has to be very determined. But as for the Shudra, Adroho Nati Manita, which means free from envy and free from the desire for prestige. He has to be humble in his heart and be willing to serve the other Varnas without any expectation of usurping their position or of being rewarded with great opulence. He's satisfied in his position, and he's willing to play his role. And he knows who he is, and he's confident in discharging his duties, and he's willing to cooperate with the other groups in society. So this is how social intercourse and how development of civilization functions smoothly is when everybody in society is performing their position very nicely. And it's also good on the collective level, but also on the individual level. Because one has acquired certain modes according to one's desires. As it says in the 13th chapter, Purusha Prakriti Stohi Bhunkte Prakriti Jangunan. He says that one acquires one's modes of material nature according to the modes one associates with in one's previous life. And in this way, one achieves a birth, whereas one has more of a Shudra Prakriti, a Vaishya, a Kshatriya, or a Brahminical one. It depends on one's actions. And the reason why we have attained this particular form, or these modes, is because of a particular desire based on our own false ego. And in order to become purified of this attachment, all we need to do is our duty. So this is why Krishna says, it is dangerous for one to perform the duty of another. Even if one performs one's own duties imperfectly, it's better than performing another's duties perfectly. Why? Because the prescribed duties that we have inherited in this life based on our previous activities is what is anchoring us to this material world. And only when we satisfy these material desires can we shed this false ego and attain liberation. By actually performing prescribed duties and trying to acquire those fruits which are due to the other varnas, we're acquiring further material desires which will give us another material birth and another material birth and so on. So by simply discharging our own prescribed duties, which is our own fault, then we can be free from this individual covering and we can attain liberation. So in this sense, it works for the individual level. But on the collective, if we don't recognize this reality of this division of social occupations, then it wreaks havoc in society. So whereas some groups may point the finger and say that this Varnashram institution, it's so outdated, it's so archaic, and we need a modern replacement, to them we would answer, well, what is your modern replacement? You don't have the Brahmanas in charge. And who's in charge instead? And Prabhupada continually says that in our present-day modern society, who is in charge? It's very much those who are stuck in passion and ignorance. It's the lowest classes, the Vaishyas and the Shudras, or material mentality. So to illustrate this point, we see that who gets elected to the prime post of prime minister of the country or president of the USA? It's always business people. Over and over again, it's people who have strong political connections through their business dealings. They're always rich people who have succeeded in industry, and they're the ones who take the top post of the country and are expected to rule the nation in a very trustworthy fashion. But the problem is if they're good in business, does not necessarily qualify them to be a qualified leader of society. Because the leader of society is the job of the Kshatriya. And what is the job of the Kshatriya? It's to protect the people. It's the willingness to sacrifice his own life for the upliftment and benefit of all the people. He has a heart towards maintaining Dharma so that everyone's interests are protected in society. And in this connection, this qualified Kshatriya who has been trained from birth to lead, he hasn't been trained to make money, mind you. He's been trained to lead in the martial sciences and political sciences. He takes advice from the Brahmana in all his duties. So even though he wields so much power and influence, still, it's being checked. By whom? By the Brahmana, who is completely absorbed in Brahman, in the absolute truth, who is fixed in scripture, who can actually give advice based on the Shastric injunctions. And so in this way, when it's compared to a social body, that when the head is dictating the movements of the body, then you can actually function smoothly in society. But if you're blindfolded, where will you go? You'll fall into a ditch. So similarly, the vaishyas represent the stomach and the shudras the legs. So if all your activities are being dictated by your lower body parts, then it'll get the whole social body in trouble. So an example of this that's very pertinent today is with our swine flu, if we actually connect. Why? Because we see that there's conflicts of interest when your vaishyas take to the highest position of influence in a society. Why? Because present day we see that all the politicians at the highest levels of government in the modern industrial nations, they have very intimate relationships with corporations, with monopoly industry, with the defense department, the pharmaceutical industry, with the automotive industry, with the oil industry. Who is our favorite president from the last 10 years? They're all involved in oil. They're all involved in military contracting, which means building tanks, building planes. And so you have people who run the society, and they declare war on a particular nation. And then the same people who declared the war are responsible for rebuilding that country with their corporations, with their families, businesses, or they're on the board of governors, they're all the chairpersons for all these companies that have to rebuild the country after you bomb it. So you have the politician that says, let's destroy this country, and then the same politician is making money to rebuild the country. And so can he actually think clearly, think straight, when there's so much money to be earned, so much profit to be gained, when your leader is tainted by this material ambition or fruitive gain, then all his decisions are tainted, corrupted, and contaminated. There's no way he can actually discharge his duties as a leader when he has a profit motive in mind. So this is always why the Kshatriyas in Vedic civilization never involved in business, and they depended purely on taxation to earn their wealth. Similarly, the Brahmanas depend purely on charity. They actually take very strict vows of poverty. The Brahmanas generally are described, at least in Bhagavad Gita, verse 1842, it says, Shamo damas tapa shaucham kshantir arjavam evacha yanam vijnanam astikyam brahmakarma svabhavajam. That what are the qualities of a Brahmana? Is that he's very austere. He's very simple. He has his mind and senses controlled. He doesn't need a huge mansion to live in. He's satisfied, like Chanakya Pandit, to live in a little cabin in the forest. And so he can actually think straight when he has no desires for sense gratification. So you find the opposite, but back to my swine flu example, is that today this is being advertised as that we have a great, not just an epidemic, but a pandemic right on our doorstep. Allegedly, millions of people, billions, are at risk of contracting this deadly virus. And what's the solution? To get vaccinated. But the same people who are working for this multinational health organization, who are recommending these vaccinations, who are contracting these pharmaceutical companies to produce these vaccines in millions and billions, the same people who are making these decisions are the same ones who are stockholders and these pharmaceutical companies. So the connection is that they may frighten the people into taking a vaccine, which may or may not even help them. The effectiveness is very suspect. But simultaneously, whether or not the vaccine works, they still make billions of dollars in the process. And it is a fact, you can check these facts on record, that most of the administration, or one particular individual in the U.S. Government administration, is one of the majority shareholders in one of these big pharmaceutical companies called La Roche. And La Roche is the biggest supplier of Tamiflu, one of the vaccines in the world. So you see that they work hand in glove, the corporations and the politicians. And this is why there's so much corruption. You find this corruption everywhere in a democracy, because the way the democracy works is that the people will elect a leader whether or not he's really qualified. The democratic election is based on popularity, on advertising, dollars or rupees spent. It's not actually on the basis of their qualities. their Kshatriya qualities. It's on the basis of their business success in the past or their just prestige in society. So this is an example of when Varnashram is not present in society, the kind of corruption and the kind of suffering that takes place as a result. So nobody is protected in a society where the Brahmanas and the Kshatriyas are not allowed to perform their duty, or even worse, the Brahmanas and the Kshatriyas are working for the Vaishyas. So we find that, I used the example earlier of how you have an intellectual like Einstein, but the problem is, he may have read the Vedas. It's a fact that he liked to memorize shlokas and he was a big fan of the Upanishads. But the problem was, he was working in the employment of a government, of these others. And so therefore, he was contracted, he was employed to build these destructive weapons that could destroy the planet. So what's the use of his intelligence if it's just being channeled to create destructive weapons? The real use of intellect is to actually understand the real problems in life and to give the solutions on the basis of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So the problem is, in our great world today, still there are so many intellectuals, but what are they studying today? They're studying engineering, commerce, economics, they're studying accounting. They go to work simply to make money. So even though so much potential is there to actually really deeply absorb oneself in scripture and to actually benefit the society at large, because this intelligence is in the employ, it's being used to serve material interests, then it's a complete spoilage, a complete waste of this great intelligence. And so this is a great tragedy when all these varnas become mixed up and one can't tell anymore. Someone may be born in a very qualified Brahminical family, may have performed all samskars from birth. So many people we meet here in India have so much knowledge of scripture, so much knowledge of these proper codes of cleanliness and of etiquette and of culture, more than anybody in the West could ever hope to attain. But unfortunately, it's all being directed towards the wrong goal. So we have to really credit Srila Prabhupada for creating a new renaissance in society where these intellectual individuals are given an opportunity that, look, you don't have to go stress out over this 9-to-5 job and work on this treadmill just running to earn money, because you're actually adopting the occupational duty of a Shudra. Anybody who accepts a boss and is accepting a salary is taking the occupational position of a Shudra. Why? Because at any moment, your boss can just decide, hey, we have too many of these guys in this department. They can cut your job like that. They can relocate you. And if you don't want to move, then they can just axe you and fire someone else. What else happens is, in America, so many qualified, you know, doctors and engineers were there who lost their jobs to Indian doctors and engineers who were willing to work for cheaper. All the white-collar jobs were outsourced to other nations. And so even though they may have been so confident about their salary, their position, their car, their prestige, still it disappeared in a second. Why? Because someone else was willing to work for cheaper. And so where do they go? They go with their degree clutched between their teeth, begging from door to door for another job. This is the unfortunate position Prabhupada is reminding us in Bhagavatam, is that we accept this doggish mentality of accepting a master. And what if the economy goes into recession? Then your job can be dismissed in a second. They say, sorry, there's not enough money for us to pay you. See you later. Good luck finding some other. So this principle of dependence is there. And this is what makes the Shudra, it's the characteristic of him, is that he's dependent on someone else for his livelihood. And so, whereas there's nothing inherently wrong with this, but the problem is, in our modern day society, we're geared towards a very exploitative system, such that, whereas a Shudra was very nicely protected in Vedic culture by others. For example, we have our example of Vidura, who, even though he was living in Dhritarashtra's palace and he was advising Duryodhan, he was so highly respected, even though the son of a Shudrani, Still, nobody, until the last ends of his days in his pastimes, still, he was a very well-respected member of the society like that. But he was also very intelligent. But to continue, the Shudras were very respected in society, and there were no real issues that they had all their needs cared for. The seniors or the higher classes were willing to provide for them, provide for their families. For example, whenever they have used clothes that they'd only worn a few times, they were willing to give it to them if like one stitch was missing or some sequins were gone. And so even the Shudras, who had a good master, always ate nicely, always had good job security, their health was properly maintained, they wore nice clothing. And so it was a real cooperative system. It's very different from our notion of slavery today. So what we find today is that one who has adopted this position of depending on a master, the problem is the boss or the company that hires you or hires us is not willing to protect us for the rest of our lives. They don't have a relationship with us based on any kind of mutual dependence. To a company that's only interested in profit, what is a worker? He's a human resource. He's just a material commodity. And if some worker in India is willing to do it for cheaper, fine, get rid of the old guy, hire him. Someone in the Philippines is willing to do it. Fine, let's take him. Oh, now we got someone in China who's willing to do it. So it's always the lowest common denominator. They're just wanting to get as much service out of someone for as little money as possible. And so the modern system is much, much more exploitative than the Vedic system, which was practiced in days of yore. So in that sense, every varna has something to offer, and everyone can also come to the transcendental platform and can achieve the supreme goal of life, which Krishna is saying, tepiyanti param gatim, the supreme destination. So before we discuss the transcendent, we've discussed the material aspect, and we're going to discuss quickly why do women fall in the same category as the Shudra or the Vaishya? And the reason is because that principle of dependence is there. Because in Manu Samhita, it's actually declared that at all stages of a woman's life, she's dependent either on her father in youth, either on her husband in her middle, and towards the end of her life, she becomes dependent on her son like that. So there's always a man in her life to offer this kind of protection and to satisfy all her needs. So on the material platform, this is the case. Whereas the way the male psychophysical characteristics are designed is they have a more innate capacity for renunciation, is that the male, he may continue as a renunciate, as a celibate for life, without that dependence necessarily on the opposite gender. So therefore, you'll find that Prabhupada would make statements that our philosophy is perfect. The Vedas, you can't find fault in there. But there's one contradiction. And what is that contradiction? Is that all the men in our society must remain brahmachari. And all the brahmacharis, yeah, Prabhupada ki jai. And he said, and all the women in our society must get married. So someone asked, how is this possible, Prabhupada? How can all the men remain brahmachari? Then who's going to marry the women? And Prabhupada said, yes, this is the contradiction. So everybody try your best. And so this is the understanding, is that that proclivity is there. However, this should not bar our transcendental knowledge or understanding that everybody on the spiritual platform is a spirit soul, and everybody is equal. The only reason there may be differences or inequalities are on the material platform. So this notion of pure material equality is fallacious. It doesn't exist. There used to be, today we're very much influenced by a philosophy coming to the Western world, which was begun during the whole social upheaval period during the 50s and 60s and 70s in America. And one of them was feminism, which was started by one very prominent social leader. Her name was Gloria Steinem. And their philosophy was that the patriarchal society in which we live is actually creating an artificial role for women just to oppress them, to keep them down, to bar them from any progress in life. And therefore, this is just a mental concoction. It's not actually scientific. And therefore, this notion of a woman having to depend on a man, this notion of a woman's role being in the house, is inherently oppressive. Therefore, we have to start rethinking gender relationships. And they coined a slogan. It was a very popular slogan for this movement, and it went, "A woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle." Does a fish need a bicycle? No, it won't even perform. It won't function underwater. How many people have seen one? And so in the same way, a woman does not need a man because it's just a creation. It's a concoction. It doesn't really have any real relationship of dependence like that. And so this quote, although it's credited to our Gloria Steinem, it was actually coined by one other lady. Her name was Dunn or something. But she was inspired to come up with a slogan after reading in a philosophy textbook of one philosopher who came up with a slogan that man needs God like a fish needs a bicycle. So originally it was an atheistic slogan. It was meant to denigrate the position of religion, the position of God, by saying that there's no real, it's just completely artificial. And so we can actually trace the relationship is that this notion is connected to very atheistic notion. It's not based on any standard shastra. It's connected to a very materialistic way of thinking. And moreover, we find that this Gloria Steinem, who adopted this mantra, she ended up founding a magazine, and it was called Ms. M-S. Ms. means a lady who's unmarried, as opposed to Mrs., which is M-R-S, which means a woman who is a wife of a husband like that. So her magazine was very boldly called Ms. Ms. Magazine. Here we are. But it's very interesting that as time wore on, in her 66th year, Gloria Steinem ended up getting married. Finally, after, you know, maybe 4 or 5 decades of very strong activism, of declaring very boldly that a woman doesn't need a man, it's all nonsense, she ended up at 66 getting married. And she was interviewed, and she says, "Yeah, I'm the happiest now I've ever been in my life." But they said, "But what about this slogan that you used? You said a woman doesn't need a man." And she said, "Oh, that wasn't my slogan. I never came up with it." And so they asked her, "Well, now that you had your Ms. Magazine before, now are you going to start Mrs. Magazine?" And so it's just one story. It's not a statement that every woman must get married, because we find that even in the Vedic civilization, there were very exalted females who did dedicate their lives 100%, fully surrendered to Krishna. They are definitely there. We have many instances. And when Prabhupada is making these statements of grouping the women and the Shudras and the merchants together, it's not a denigration against women's material intelligence, because the facts don't bear that out. You can do your IQ test and you'll find that women will be the same or even greater than men. We find that even in society, they can adopt all the same roles: CEO, astronaut, you know, inventor, engineer. There's no difference in terms of their ability, their intellectual power in that sense. But the difference, according to scripture, of where the intelligence differs is in terms of the process by which they attain to realization, by which they attain to spiritual realization. So the notion of intelligence, whether it's a Shudra's or a Vaishya's or a woman's intelligence, is actually given by Prabhupada in the Nectar of Instruction, wherein he describes that there are 3 kinds of intelligence. The first is to learn by hearing. This is given in Bhagavad Gita, as Shrotra din indriyanyanye samyam agnishu juvati shabdadin vishayananya indriyagnishu juvati. Krishna is saying in the 4th chapter that the sacrifice for the unadulterated brahmachari is the hearing process, simply by becoming absorbed in the Vedic scriptures and by being related with this sound vibration. An unadulterated brahmachari, who is naishtika, can actually realize the purport of Bhagavad Gita, and he can come straight to the platform of surrender. Sarva dharman parityaja, give up all his varnashram duties, give up all his family responsibilities, come to full surrender on the spot. So this is the brahmachari. In the next section of this verse, he says, but another sacrifice is for the householder who shabdadin vishaya nanya indriyagnishu juvati. He sacrifices his senses in the fire of sense control. And in this way, he actually progresses in devotional service. So he heard it. The Gita is saying that what is man and woman? It's just an artificial, temporary designation. That the man might be a woman in the next life, the woman might be a man, you might be a shudra, you might be a dog. All these designations are changing from birth to birth. And so it sounds good, in theory. If it's really the case that you're not this body, then let's just surrender today. For the householder, who is not on that platform of realization, he discharges his duty, or his or her duty, in devotional service, according to the body he or she has. And by engaging with the sense objects, which is your house, your job, your money, your car, your curtains, by engaging with all these, this field of activities under regulation as a sacrifice to the Lord, then you come to that realization. So the realization of the brahmachari, realization of the householder, is the same in the ultimate issue. Just the process is different. So in the same way, first class intelligence by hearing, second class intelligence by seeing. Someone may see, you know, this and that person fighting and say, oh, I don't want to get involved with that. Or you may see so many instances in the scripture of these devotees, and you may attain realization like that. But third class intelligence is considered learning by doing, learning by experience. That even though my mother told me, hey, you watch out for that hot griddle, you know, where you put the chapatis. Very hot. Don't put your hands there. But the curious child, is he satisfied just by hearing? In many cases, he's not. He just has to test out for himself. So this is third class intelligence. You touch it, you get burned, but if you're smart, you never do it again. And so in the same way, this is why the sacrifices are given. And this is why the woman is given, generally speaking, the grihastha ashram to join. Because simply by having a nice family life, by having all of these kind of opulences and this kind of satisfaction to the senses that's available in a luxurious or more opulent environment than an ashram, then she can attain the exact same realization and attain to the ultimate destination. And so this is the principle, is that everybody must perform their own duty. And everybody has a different duty according to the modes that they find themselves situated in, the body that they've acquired. And what Krishna is emphasizing in this verse is that tepiyanti param gatim, they all go to the same supreme destination like that. And in some senses, it's even an advantage for a woman who has a good husband. She will attain to his same destination, that the man at time of death, antakali chamameva smaran muktva kalevaram, that he has to be absorbed in Krishna, in the absolute, and he will attain that accordingly. But it's actually spoken in the Dharma Shastras that a woman simply has to remember her husband at the time of death, and she gets the same destination. She does not necessarily have to be absorbed in transcendence in the same way, because automatically she'll follow in the footsteps of her husband. But this behooves the husband to actually become qualified, actually follow scripture as well. So though we could speak on this much further, one final point is that there's hope for everyone in devotional life. And the verse that Prabhupada mentions in this purport as well is that these Vaishyas and Shudras, they're part of Varnashram. And Krishna says, Mamhi Partha Vyapashritya, that if they take exclusive shelter of me, ashritya, they dedicate themselves to me personally, Krishna, in my two-handed form, then they get the supreme destination. But everyone, Prabhupada is mentioning in this verse, is actually following Varnashram nicely. That's the insinuation. So the question may come, what if you're outside of Varnashram? Then what hope do you have? And so this is why Bhagavatam expands on this verse. And the verse is given in the Bhagavatam of Kirata Hunandra Pulinda Pulkasha Abhira Shumba Yava Nakasadayaha Yenyecha Papa Yara Pashraya Shrayaha Shudhyanti Tasmai Prabha Vishnave Namaha. That the Kiratas, the Hunas, who are the Hunas? They're the Slavic people who live in Germany and Russia. The Pulindas are the Greeks. The Abhiras are the Sindhis. In Andhras, in South India, we have the Khasas. They're the ones who live in Mongolia, in China. We find that they're the ones who are living outside of Bharatkhand. Outside of India are those who are not practicing Varnashram. They don't have the Vedic scriptures to guide them. They may have some reflection of the Vedas, but they're engaged in all kinds of sinful activities. Krishna says, Yinye cha papa. And then of those races we've talked about, there's others who are even more fallen. Krishna doesn't mention those who are living in the Western world, farther away in Western Europe or in America. He says, Yinye, ye anye, even others. So what hope do they have? This is the question, is that it's all theoretical. Before Prabhupada came along, someone may have read this verse from Bhagavatam and said, oh yes, very nice. Even all these dog eaters, all these mleches and yavanas, they can get the mercy of the Lord. But has anybody witnessed this? Who saw it take place? All the Vedas were simply concentrated in India. Sannyasis were forbidden from traveling overseas. None of this knowledge was ever disseminated to any of these races, only very indirectly. So what is the hope for one of these Kiratas, Hunas, Andras, Pulindas, Pulkashas? Where is the hope? Yinye cha papa yad apashraya ashrayaha. Ashraya is one who has taken shelter of God, one who is in this position of ashritya. However, one who is apashraya ashrayaha is one who has taken shelter of one who has taken shelter of the Lord, one who has taken shelter of the devotee. So even if you're not part, you're not a good Vaishya, you're not a good Shudra who's respecting your seniors and full of non-enviousness, you're not a very chaste lady. It doesn't matter because you take shelter of the devotee and he is more merciful than the Lord. The Lord's devotee is actually able to purify one, has more capacity for purification than the Lord does. Because he's willing to go to these countries and educate these races in the knowledge of devotional service. And so what we see is Srila Prabhupada is actually the living manifestation of these prophecies in the Bhagavatam, in the Bhagavad Gita. Before Prabhupada, who is actually going there, educating these people? No one. And so we find that Prabhupada is the one who is charged with translating these scriptures in the English language. Before that, this knowledge was totally unknown, and none of these races, none of these lower fallen classes had any chance of upliftment. It's only by the grace of a pure devotee of the Lord that any of us has any real chances or any real opportunities for success in this life. So before we try to get too angry at Prabhupada's verses, we should try to adopt this fallen position and really say that, am I really following the Dharma Shastras nicely? Am I a bona fide member of Varnashram Dharma? When Prabhupada's talking about these Varna Sankara, he's talking about us. And what is the hope for us is to take shelter of his books, take shelter especially of the chanting of the holy names. Because it's stated that anybody can attain to the lotus feet of the Lord, whether regardless of your gender, your race, regardless of whatever social position you have. And what is the proof of this? We find that on this platform of pure devotional service, Haridas Thakur became the Namacharya. We find that in Jharkhand Forest, Lord Chaitanya, he even induced the animals to chant the holy name. Anybody can perfect their lives, even if you're a tiger or a deer. And we find in Chaitanya Leela that during the pastime of Shivananda Sen, when Lord Chaitanya came back from Vrindavan to Puri, all the devotees in Bengal, they were so eager to go meet Lord Chaitanya in Jagannath Puri. And so they got a huge yatra party together and they set out on foot. And Shivananda Sen, on his way there, he happened to bring a little pet dog with him. And he would feed it and care for it and love it very affectionately. And along the whole way, he brought this dog with him. But one day, Shivananda Sen, he actually was caught up working with a toll man. He got so busy, he forgot to feed his dog. And he asked his servant, "Oh, did you feed any cooked rice to my dog like I had asked you?" And the servant said, "Oh, we forgot." And so, where is he? And they went looking for the dog. And they sent out a search party of 10 people to find him, but nobody could find the dog. And so Shivananda Sen, he became so despondent, he decided to fast, and he didn't eat. And they continued, they trudged along. In such lamentation, he continued along to Jagannath Puri, and they met Lord Chaitanya, and Lord Chaitanya took them for darshan of Lord Jagannath. And still, he was in such a morose mood. But the next morning, when they went to meet Lord Chaitanya, they entered the room, and sure enough, right next to Lord Chaitanya was this dog, same dog, sitting there, and was eating happily the remnants of Lord Chaitanya. Gauranga Mahaprabhu was feeding the dog green coconut pulp that he was snacking on and just throwing to the dog. And Lord Chaitanya was laughing, and he pointed at the dog and he said, "Please chant, Ram, Krishna, Hari, chant." And the dog was eating and he goes, "Krishna, Krishna," like that. The dog was chanting. And Shivananda Sen, when he saw this same dog, his old pet there, he became so humbled by this experience that he offered his obeisances to the dog right there. He gave his full dandavats like that. This is the interactions, the pastimes of the transcendental associates of the Lord. And so the next day, Shivananda Sen, he was so proud of his pet dog, he went to go find it, but they found that the dog had left its body. The next day, after chanting, the dog was no longer here in his manifest leelas. The dog had actually gone back home, back to Vaikuntha Loka. Just by the association, a second's association of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, by chanting the holy names, even a dog can attain to the supreme perfection of life. So Prabhupada in that purport, he exalts all his devotees. Let us learn from this. Our lives, in one sense, are already successful. By the association of a pure devotee, a Bhagavat, through his works, through the individual, we have already, in a large sense, attained to perfection to the degree that we dedicate ourselves. So instead, let us adopt this very compassionate mood and feed other people prasad. Let us induce others to chant. And even if they're not highly qualified in terms of their varnashram and their cleanliness and all their duties, still, they can attain to the supreme perfection of life. Just by chanting, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare, Hare, Hare Ram, 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 Hare, Hare. Would any of you like to ask any questions before we dismiss for Shayan Darshan? Jai Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Shri Radha Gopinath Bhagavan ki, Nitai Gaur Premanande, Hari Hari Bol.